You know, at the GCE, we attended a number of events, some of which you got to participate in because we had the hookup. But there's a lot of different events there, workshops on different topics. One of the workshops, it was sort of the brainchild behind the discussion group we're going to do here in 2 weeks. But there was a Bible study that happened that Sabbath morning before services that I was very impressed with, because it got me thinking about something that I thought I knew, that I thought that I felt pretty good about, and then it made me think about it in a different way, and it made me want to go back and do some more research. And since we know, our Bibles are full of things that we know and things that we haven't yet learned, or haven't yet learned to fully appreciate, whenever we get this kind of an opportunity in our life, it can be kind of exciting. Afterwards, I spoke to Mr. Petty, and I said, something jumped out at me when you read this, and you didn't cover this per se, but you did allude to it, and I just want to know if I'm thinking on the same lines that, you know, can we take this from Scripture? And I told him what I took from his message, and he says, you know, that's a good way to look at it as well. I never thought about presenting it in that way. So what I'd like to do today is I'd like to present some of the highlights that he was getting at in his message, and then add this bit of a twist to it. His presentation was simply called Justice, Mercy, and Faith. The Bible study was on the theme of the weekend, and the theme of the GCE this year is the weightier matters of the law. It's what they were trying to get the church to focus on throughout this year. And so after hearing that and kind of putting this message together, I put a small twist on that message that I call, how do you practice justice, mercy, and faith? And I'll get to the reason of why I put this in the form of a question, simply taking the statement he did. Now, this is all based on a passage that we all know and we've read many, many times, but it also refers back to a passage that we don't often read very often. And that's sort of where the idea for this message came from. So if you'd like to start, turn over to Matthew 23. And we'll start there. Now, the context of Matthew 23 is a stinging rebuke of the Pharisees. And I think it's important to kind of, in our minds, kind of know who these people are. Oftentimes, in our New Testament, the Pharisees are the bad guys. And we're always looking at them as kind of jousting with Christ and going head-to-head on him on all these different topics. But, you know, if you read about Christ doing all of this jousting between the Sadducees and the Pharisees, and then you go back and you look in the Old Testament, you won't see those words anywhere. You won't. So who are these people that were so important at the time of Christ that you can't find anywhere in the Old Testament? So it does take a little bit of study to go through and understand this, and just a very quick little synopsis of who they were. You know, at the kingdom period, you had a king over Israel, and you had a temple where all the worship system took place. And so there was two basic leadership positions within Israel. One was the spiritual leadership that happened from the temple worship, and you had a high priest. Going back to the beginning, it was Aaron, brother of Moses, and Moses was the civil leader of the people. And all through time, the civil leader changed. You know, you had King David, you had Solomon, you had all these different kings. Some of them were good kings, some of them were bad. And all along, you had a high priest who was a member of the Levitical priesthood, and he ran the temple worship system. He appeared before the whole congregation on the Day of Atonement. He was the only one that could go into the Holy of Holies, and that's kind of how it worked. So when you get to the New Testament and you hear these other names, you're thinking, well, how does this work out? The Sadducees are descendants of that Levitical priesthood. They got to keep their job when Israel was taken into captivity. So when Babylon came and took them all away, Everybody left, and they were all gone. And then when King Cyrus allowed them to come back, and remember Ezra and Nehemiah, and they kind of rebuilt the wall and then the temple and kind of started things up. The temple system got going again after what's called the Second Temple period. And so the high priest, the Levitical priesthood, took back over their role as kind of spiritual leaders. There was a pretty famous guy we all know from the Bible, Ezra. And the Bible refers to him as a scribe. And a scribe is somebody who would take the scriptures and write them letter for letter, character for character, and make duplicates of the scripture so that there could be more than one copy. And this is how things were done. And among the scribes were a number of people that spent a huge amount of time in scripture, way more time than the priesthood spent. And over time, they began to realize that the Bible isn't something that only the priesthood should be able to understand. And this is really kind of the birth of what became the Pharisees. The Pharisees is a name that basically means to separate. And their idea was, you need to kind of come out of this civil mess that we call a people, because they weren't under their own king, like in the times of old. They were under the Persians, then they were under the Greeks, and there were always these legal ramifications of the people who controlled them. And the Pharisees wanted this idea of everybody can be holy. Why just the priesthood is holy? And God refers to his people as set apart and special. And so they sort of began to compete with the Sadducees for the hearts and the minds of the people. And over time, the Pharisees, in some respects, had more of an open mind than the Sadducees, and that they saw that, you know what, there's inspiration from God. There is direct revelation from God on things, and that's why in the time of Christ, the Pharisees believed in the resurrection. The Sadducees did not. Because if you go through the scriptures, you might see that section in Ezekiel about those dry bones and say, well, that's a resurrection, but it's kind of cryptic. And to try to understand what it means, it doesn't really imply that every single person is going to be resurrected. And the Sadducees were very by the book. Well, because they were one of the few leaders that came from the people that all of the Greeks that were controlling there liked, there became kind of a corrupt power structure, and some of the Sadducees became quite corrupt. And at the time of the Maccabees, 300 years before Christ, some of those loyal Sadducees and a big bunch of those Pharisees got together, and they overthrew those that were trying to keep them oppressed, and they won their freedom for a time. And so the Sadducees and Pharisees were not always at each other's throats. A lot of them united at that time for their freedom. They united together against Christ. But ultimately, the Pharisees won out when the temple was destroyed, because at that point, Sadducees were out of a job, and their power disappeared when the temple disappeared. So this is sort of this small little story here to explain this problem that went on. Both sides were trying to influence the people and to have ultimate authority. And both sides succeeded in different ways. The Sanhedrin had their authority. The Pharisees built the synagogues and maintained that system. So that was kind of separate from the temple worship system. And so there was these two different competing ideas on how to win the hearts and the minds of the people. Now, when Jesus came on the scene, he saw how these people were kind of messing things up. And let's pick it up in Matthew 23 and verse 1. Matthew 23 and verse 1. Then Jesus spoke to the multitude and to his disciples, saying, the scribes and the Pharisees, he's talking about the Pharisees and the Sadducees here, sit in Moses' seat. And therefore, whatever they tell you to observe, that observe and do, but do not do according to their works, for they say and they do not do. So what he's saying is, these people are your leaders, they have some authority, but don't follow their example. Their example is going to steer you wrong. And he goes into great detail on all their faults, and that everyone could see, and everyone could see how they conducted themselves. And he exposes their hypocrisy in that they did not care what burden they put on others as long as they felt justified. And this is that word justified we're going to talk about today. As long as they felt they were doing what was right and let the chips fall where they may. And they never seemed to care about their fellow man, especially the little ones or the little guy. And when you see so many times Christ talking about the poor, the fatherless, those people who are kind of suffering in the margins, he was calling out how the leadership of the people of Israel had pretty much failed. Even though they had plans, it's not that nobody could have a system to take care of the poor, but their heart wasn't in it. And so the poor suffered. And Christ picked up on that on many, many times. And oftentimes when they did things, they wanted credit for it. So when they would fast, they would let everyone know they were fasting so that everyone could say, wow, look how pious that person is. So there was a lot of hypocrisy where they were doing things to seem religious, and in so doing, they were doing this to get the compassion or the support of the people. So it must have been especially difficult for them to hear in verse 23, if you want to move forward a little bit, Matthew 23:23, it says, "Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for you pay tithe of mint and anise and cumin, and neglected the weightier matters of the law, justice and mercy and faith. These you ought to have done without leaving the others undone." Now these herbs here are some of the lightest things that existed. And so if you're going to pay tithes on these things, it's done by weight, you know, one-tenth. So you're weighing something that weighs almost nothing. And you're spending a huge amount of time trying to figure out what 10% of nothing weighs. And they spent more time on that than worrying about their fellow man. Some of the big ideas, some of the heavier topics that they should have been focusing on. Now, of course, these people, these leaders on both sides, felt very justified in the way they conducted themselves. Whether they only followed in the priesthood, only followed that which was in the physical scriptures that they had, or what the Pharisees followed, which was not just in the physical scriptures, but in the oral Torah that was never written down until hundreds of years after Christ. So what it was and who started it and how it was started is still a bit of a myth and legend as it is. And then they had their commentaries and some of their other things that they came up with to try to make sure things stayed a certain way. And if you understand the fact that when they came out of captivity, the leaders of the people were very determined to make sure that they followed the law. That it was because they kept turning their back on God that they kept ending up in captivity. And so, you know, you read what Nehemiah did, and he was pretty strong on keeping the law, and he felt, you know, it's really important that we don't make these mistakes again, because we don't want to end up into captivity again. And so the Pharisees went so far as to actually create these, what would they call, fence laws. So if it prevents somebody from getting even close to breaking one of the laws, that's better yet. And so you can do a lot of research if you want, and they can talk about all the different individual tenets. One of the ones that's often talked about is, you know, the law says you can't create a flame on the Sabbath. The Pharisees had this idea that as long as you started the fire before the Sabbath, then you would have fire throughout the Sabbath, where the priesthood says, no, your food should be cold. You should just eat it cold. You know, everyone likes cold chicken, right? You know, so don't cook anything for the Sabbath, and let's obey it that way. The Pharisee says, no, you just can't start a fire. So as long as the fire is going, you can keep it going. So you had all these different viewpoints on different topics, and always competing for the hearts and minds of the people. So how do you keep these concepts of justice, mercy, and faith in proper perspective, in balance? Picture, if you will, a stool, a three-legged stool. And if any one of the three legs disappeared or was weak, how sturdy would that stool be? If you sat in it and there was one leg that was about to collapse, down you go. And so we have to keep these in balance. And so if you think that you can have justice without mercy, Jesus says over and over, you can't. You cannot have justice without mercy, because without mercy there is no justice. Now, how do we know that? Because Christ died for us, all sinners. We didn't earn anything. Without that mercy, none of us have a chance. So if that's a salvation issue, then it's a pretty big part of what justice is. Without mercy, there is no justice. And it's one of those things that the leaders back then struggled with, as to how to have mercy. Now, what if you had a heart of gold and mercy isn't your problem? You've got mercy galore. You know, anybody needs something, you're the first one. You've heard the phrase, that guy would give the shirt off his own back. There are people like that in the world. And some of them are wonderful examples. But what if you had so much mercy, you gave away everything, the food from your table, you give away your house so that others could live there, and then you have no house, and now you're homeless. Or you give away all your food, and now your kids have nothing to eat. What if you have too much mercy? Well, it's got to be in balance. People have to grow. People have to learn. And you have to be able to take care of your responsibilities as well. Again, all three of these have to be in balance. You can't have faith and do nothing about it. Faith without works is dead. So you can't just have faith either. So how do you keep them in balance? One of the big parts of the story was, what is justice? Part of the study that we went through, what is justice? Now, we talked a while back about the concept of remes, where something in the New Testament is sort of referred back to it refers back to something in the Old Testament. When we read this, justice, mercy, and faith, there is a section in there that is a remes of a concept that came from the Old Testament. This is not the first time the idea of having balance to be a whole person was talked about. Turn over to Micah 3. Micah 3. Now, most of you don't find yourself reading Micah very often. A while back, I started in Micah and just started reading. And I was noticing how each of the books had really similar themes. And you go through all of those minor prophets, and I read all the way to the end of the Old Testament, to Malachi. I read 7 books. They're not long books. They didn't take a long time. But I noticed how there's this theme that all of these had, that Israel was turning their back on God, and how God felt about Israel turning their heart away from him. And the opening of Micah 3 has some interesting wording. In fact, let me just read verse 3 of Micah 6. Verse 3 of Micah 6. O my people, what have I done to you? And how have I wearied you? Testify against me. It's a weird word, testify, to be put in this context. When you read Expositor's Bible Commentary on this passage, it says Micah 6 placed the setting here in a legal context, as he pictured God's pleading with his people in court. You know, let's go to trial and figure out why this always happens to you and why we are in this situation. I would like to know is what God is pleading with his people. The mood of the passage is at first foreboding, as the opening words summon God to arise and state his case against Israel. But the passage takes on an atmosphere of pathos or passion, as God is pictured as asking his people how he has wearied them. How have I so tired you out that you just have given up on me? Has it been so hard? Has it been so bad? And the creator of those mountains seeks the cause of Israel's estrangement from him. And so he says, I call mountains against you as witnesses to what you guys are doing and what you guys are thinking. So with that in mind, let's continue on here in verse 4. And so God is testifying here, and he says, for I brought you up from the land of Egypt, I redeemed you from the house of bondage, and I sent you before you Moses, Aaron, and Miriam. So he tells them that he gave them all that they needed to succeed. He fed them, he led them, and he taught them. What more do they need? And he asks in verse 6, with what shall I come before the Lord and bow myself before the high God? Shall I come before him with burnt offerings, with calves a year old? Will the Lord be pleased with thousands of rams, 10,000 rivers of oil? Shall I give my firstborn for my transgression, the fruit of my body for the sin of my soul? There were cultures out there that would actually sacrifice their children to try to win favor with God. And God is saying, is this what's going to take for you to be reconciled with me? And then he gives them the heart of the matter here. Micah 6, verse 8. He has shown you, O man, what is good. And what does the Lord require of you but to do justly, to love mercy, and to walk humbly with your God? Now, at first you say, well, this is similar to what's in the Matthew 23:23. Instead of justice, mercy, and faith, we have justice, mercy, and humility. But remember, they didn't have the Holy Spirit yet. God wanted their hearts. He wanted them to humbly look at him and to follow and to trust and to give them their heart. And he says these words, and this was the original title I thought about calling this message. Instead of how to practice justice, mercy, and faith, I thought about calling this message to do, to love, and to walk. And I asked Mr. Petty, what do you think about this concept about how to do justice, mercy, and faith? He says it's an interesting concept because each of those words has its own meaning and its own admonition for the hearer, and each word is a little different. And when you look at those three words, justice, mercy, and faith, you begin to see a relationship with each of those words. And so before we start talking about how to put to do, to love, and to walk in practice, let's take a closer look at these words that the leaders there seem to go wrong on. And let's look at this word justice and ask ourselves what it means. What does it mean to have justice from God's point of view? I'd like you to turn over to Genesis 18. You know, everybody's got the idea of what justice means. You know, there's that show Justice with whoever her name is on one of the judges shows, where you go and you find out what the judge thinks on this topic or that. You've got those, remember those riots back a while back, and you see those signs, no justice, no peace. I remember at the time somebody did a kind of a religious take on there, and there was just two signs, and it was no justice, no peace, N-O justice, N-O peace. And then right next to it, it said K-N-O-W, justice, K-N-O-W, peace. And I thought, oh, that's clever. You know, no justice, no peace. And I like that. But everybody's got this idea of what justice means. For some, it's getting what they deserve. For others, it's giving others what they deserve. What does this word really mean to God? Let's read in Genesis 18, in verse 19. For I have known him in order that he may command his children and his household after him, that they keep the way of the Lord. So we already have the context here that this is a good thing, that somebody's on the right track, They're keeping the way of the Lord. And then it says, to do righteousness and justice, that the Lord may bring to Abraham what he has spoken to him. So what does that mean to you? Righteousness and justice. When I think of those words, I think, well, it kind of means to have the right heart. That would be righteousness. And to do justice, which is to do the right things. So have the right heart, and then do the right things when you have the right heart. And that makes sense. I'd like to read for you the King James Version of the same exact passage. And it says, "For I know him, that he will command his children and his household after him, and that they shall keep the way of the Lord to do justice and judgment, that the Lord may bring upon Abraham which he had spoken of him." So the first one said righteousness and justice, and the version that it was inspired from, the New King James, came from the King James. The original said justice and judgment. Now I'm getting more confused. It's hard to just kind of say, well, I think that just means have a good heart and do the right things. So now it's time to let's look up some words and see what they really mean. Now this word that we read is righteousness in the New King James, or justice in the Old King James, is this word, I'm going to spell it. I'm not very good at pronouncing some of these words. This is the spelling of this word, T-S-E-D-A-Q-A-H. So if you can figure out how to pronounce that, I'm not going to try. But it's Strong's 6666. There's a number for you. So this is this word that is translated as righteousness. Now it means it is translated in different passages as either justice or righteousness. So they're kind of interchangeable. But what does it really mean? And it is a kind of a broader definition. It's like righteousness in government, or the law of a judge, a ruler, or a king. It's the attributes of God as given in government. It's how God would run the show if God was running the show. If God was your judge and you went before him on every matter, it's how he would rule. And it's the way he would conduct and set up his government. And it's just sort of, if you had laws in your country that were fair, and they would say fair or just, that's what this word means. It's living in a society where things are run God's way. So the speed limits are fair. The criminal code was written fairly. Everything was done in a right way so that you would have a pretty good society. That's that first word. Now, what's the second word? In the New King James, it was justice. And in the Old King James, judgment. This is this word, mishpat. It's M-I-S-H-P-A-T. Mishpat. The Strong's 49:41. Now, again, this word is also translated judgment or justice. So it's depending on how it's used, they use one word or the other. Now, it is the act of deciding a case. If you were the judge, if you were Solomon, and two women came to you and said, "That's my child," and someone else says, "No, that's my child," the act in which you would decide whose child it is what this word means. This is discernment. So what this passage in Genesis is saying is, if you want to keep the way of the Lord, you will have a society that's based on God's way of life, in fairness and all of those things, that the laws are good. But on top of that, the second word is that you would have discernment to be able to decide. The act of deciding a case placed before the court or seat of judgment, and it's the process or procedure of the litigation before a judge so that he can pronounce a proper sentence. This is the part the Pharisees and Sadducees got wrong. This is the part where they messed up. Because they each had kind of their own rules on how to govern. And the playbook for the Pharisees were bigger than the playbook for the Sadducees. But they understood certain things they had in common, but there were things that they didn't. And so they often emphasized the things that were different from one another versus trying to come to a consensus and says, what does God want? How do you take what we know and apply this to what does God want? And that's what they were failing with. So in Micah 6:8, the word justly is this same word mishpat. To do justice or to do justly means to live your life learning how to discern right from wrong, good from bad, and knowing when to show mercy. You know, they say, I'm going to throw myself on the mercy of the court. That only works if the court has mercy. You know, if you're coming before Judge Roy Beam, the hanging judge, good luck with that mercy defense. So, what they got wrong and what they couldn't understand is that they were supposed to learn how to properly do justice. It's about discernment. And I want you to think about some of the things, and we don't have time to cover them all, but we can discuss them a little bit here. What were some of the disputes that Jesus had with some of these religious leaders? Number one had to have been how to conduct himself on the Sabbath. And they were always accusing him of breaking the law. Now, we know Christ could not be our Savior if he did break the law. So why were they wrong so much of the time? Well, the answer is found in the way that Jesus talked to them. I mean, you could say, he could have said, I'm God, you're wrong. That's it. End of discussion. Nope, he didn't do that. Ox in the ditch. He reasoned with them. He says, would you allow your animal to suffer until the Sabbath was over? Do you feed your animals on the Sabbath? Or do you let them just fast every week? He reasoned with them. Talked about how to reason, how to discern right from wrong. It's like, well, but the law clearly states, what does the law mean? How do you apply mercy with justice together? And he would always present stories that got you thinking. The Good Samaritan. What is the requirement of a Samaritan anyway? They were thought of as some of the lowest of the low. Why? Because when the Assyrians invaded the northern kingdom of Israel and yanked all those people out, all their brethren, and took them and scattered amongst the Assyrian Empire, they put people that they had displaced elsewhere in their place. And those people became to be known as the Samaritans. People who don't belong. They don't deserve to be here. And so they weren't thought of very well. And so Christ used the story of the Good Samaritan to say, maybe you really don't know what you should be and shouldn't be associating yourselves with. You separate yourself from what you think is bad. And here's a story that might turn that on its head a little bit. What is good? When he asked them, is it lawful or unlawful to do good on the Sabbath? He's asking them to discern. Some of them, we have record, learned to do that. The Apostle Paul called himself a Pharisee of Pharisees. Some of them figured it out. Let's take one that was argued quite a bit over time. Turn over to Numbers 15. Numbers 15. Let's take an example about breaking the Sabbath and ask ourselves, how do we discern this today? Because we believe today that we shouldn't break the Sabbath. They understood then that they shouldn't break the Sabbath. So let's ask ourselves some discernment between then and now. Numbers 15, starting in verse 33. And those who found him gathering sticks brought him to Moses and Aaron and to all the congregations, and they put him under guard because it had not been explained what they should do to him. Now, why is gathering sticks a problem? Well, he was doing so on the Sabbath. And there was no statute, you know, that says penal code section such and such tells you in this situation this is what you should do. So they brought him and put him under guard and said, let's let God tell us what to do. So the Lord said to Moses, the man must surely be put to death. And then he says this, all the congregation shall stone him with stones outside the camp. And so as the Lord commanded Moses, all the congregation brought him outside the camp and stoned him with stones, and he died. And again the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, speak to the children of Israel. So in lieu of the fact that you just all had to go out and kill this man that broke the Sabbath, hear what I'm about to tell you. Tell them to take tassels on the corners of their garments throughout their generations, and to put a blue thread of tassels on the corners, and that you shall have the tassel, that you may look upon it and remember all the commandments of the Lord and do them. And that you may not follow the harlotry to which your own heart and your own eyes are inclined. Obviously, that man who was gathering the sticks was thinking, I need wood for the fire and I could wait, but I don't think it's a big deal. And so he decided for himself what was right and what was wrong, and he decided amiss. And so God is saying, I don't want to have you people stoning people left and right. So maybe if you guys can't understand that these 10 things are pretty important, maybe you should do this. So Mr. Petty was talking about, somebody come up and asked him about tassels. And he says, well, originally it was given as a punishment. It was a punishment for not keeping the Sabbath. He says, I love the Sabbath. I keep the Sabbath because I look forward to it. I cherish it. I guard it. I care a lot about the Sabbath. But if you don't, maybe tassels are for you. Maybe if you can't remember, do not kill, do not bear false witness, you can't seem to leave your neighbor's wife alone, maybe you need to have something that's going to remind you, because it was a punishment. And so we got to ask ourselves about these punishments. Do we stone people today for anything? Say, well, we don't have the civil authority over us the way they did back then. And that's one way to look at it. But then again, Christ was given the opportunity as the ultimate authority to stone that woman who everything we know shows that she was guilty. Because he didn't say, I don't find you guilty. He says, go and sin no more. So from Scripture, we can infer that she probably was guilty, and he showed mercy. So we have these ideas here that we are supposed to find ways to really love what God is trying to do and to put it in pretty good importance in our minds, so that we can grow toward that person that God wants us to be. And as Christ was trying to tell people that day, you guys have missed the point entirely. You're doing things, but for the wrong reasons. And then you're missing the boat half the time. And your motivation is about yourself and your power and your position. And that's not going to get you anywhere. So let's look at this alternate title we talked about. To do, to love, and to walk. To do justly, or to do justice. Let's apply these to our three words from Matthew 23. Justice, mercy, and faith. To do justice doesn't imply that it's something that comes out of your pores. It's something that we actually learn, and we learn this through doing. And you don't know how you're going to react in a given situation until actually you're faced in that situation. And one of the things that's interesting to share, and why roundtable discussions can be very useful at times, is people will share stories with you and say, wow, I've never been confronted with that. I don't know what I would do in that situation. And so to do justly is just that. You step out and you start to learn to discern. And you're going to make mistakes. Sometimes you're going to say, you know, I ruled this way once upon a time. And I've talked to many, many fathers whose kids have left the church, who have said, you know, we were pretty hard on those kids back in the day. Do this, do that, do this. This is what the church says to do, and we will do it. And the kid's heart was never in it. And they never learned to reach the heart of their kids, but they were doing it. And what good did it do if their children left? Now, their children might never been called. And I like to believe that God has a purpose for everyone, and they will have their time. But we do these things that we call justice, trying to live in the society that God would want us to live in with the kind of rules and regulations that are proper and that bring peace and harmony. But they're only going to work if you do the next thing, to love. To love. And what is the next thing on our list? Mercy. The thing that we're supposed to love is mercy. Now, why should we love mercy? Why is that important? Of all these things, if you're going to love anything, why is mercy the thing that we should love? Because none of us are getting there without mercy. None of us have a chance for eternity without mercy. It had better be something that we love if we hope ourselves to be a part of that kingdom of God. And if we love mercy that much, maybe be willing to give it out from time to time. Not ever be thought of as a hanging judge. So, when you think about it that way, I'm going to love mercy. I'm going to put my thoughts and my mind on mercy. Then you start thinking, well, how does that make me feel when I see things around me? That seems wrong to me. But why does it seem wrong to me? Well, because I might have had some experiences that that person doesn't have yet. Maybe they haven't learned what I've learned. Maybe they just haven't got there yet. Is there something that I haven't got yet? I know there's a list. And I know that every single time I've asked God to show me something that I'm doing wrong, before the sun sets, He shows me. Scared me to death when I asked God bluntly to show me something that I'm doing wrong. So we have to love mercy. And I always pray, God, I need to know some things, but can you please put some sugar in on that medicine? Because it was really hard to swallow the last time you showed me. So when you start using mercy because we love it so much, we begin to understand the differences between us, and we start saying, yeah, you know, I wouldn't do that if I were that person. But I'm not that person, and I don't have their experiences, and so I'm going to find a way to reach that person. And maybe the only way, since I don't have a really close relationship, if I have a very close relationship with someone, and I've done this on occasion, when I'm very close to someone and I see them doing something that just isn't right, I'll go up to them, I'll say, you know, can I ask you about this? Can I talk to you about this? And I'm not talking to you as a pastor, I'm talking to you as a friend. And if there are people that you're that close to and you see something that clearly seems wrong, then I would hope that you could do that. But we don't have that relationship with everyone, do we? There are people we just know as brethren. We see them on the Sabbath. Maybe they've been to our house once or twice. And so how do you reach those people? Mercy tells me God has had the proper example around me all these years, and I'm finally learning this lesson. And I learned this lesson after decades of being around a good example. So maybe that is how we reach someone, is we offer them a good example. And we don't worry about knocking on their door and saying, by the way, you need to stop this or that. Because I want to reach them. As Paul says, to all, I became all things to all people that I might win some. Because you're not going to win everybody. And then this last one, to walk. That means how you live each day. In the Old Testament, God was asking for humility. In the New, He's asking for faith, to walk with faith. There's a certain assuredness about the term walk. Can you walk through a minefield for a very short time? How do you have faith? When you see that first guy find a mine, how do you walk with faith after that? And that's what happens in our lives. We're going through, everything's going fine, and we see somebody, something terrible happened to someone, and our mind immediately goes back, it could happen to me. I could be next. I could be the next person to get sick. I could be the next person to lose my job. I could be the next person who's homeless. It could happen to me. We use this term walk because it's what we do to get from here to there. And if you were going to get from here to there, you can do so in fear. You can do so in agony. Or you can do so with a peace of mind that God's got this. That whatever God has in store for you, you're going to learn it when it's time. And you're going to grow as He shows you things. And as you see examples from others. And maybe even from a very close friend who says, hey, have you thought of this before? And you begin to learn to walk by faith. Where we all read the scriptures, don't worry about what you're going to eat, what you're going to drink, what you're going to wear. The flowers, God takes care of the flowers. Flowers never worry. Sometimes those flowers die. Sometimes the birds don't eat. Or they're eaten by another bird. Bad things happen in this world. But they don't worry is the lesson. So when you walk by faith, because you love mercy and you know that God is going to look after you, and then you use that to temper that which you call justice. And every one of us will have a different flavor of justice. If you like watching these shows where there's a judge and there's a lawyer, I mean, we always make these jokes about how bad lawyers are, but in these shows, the lawyers are always the crusaders, right? They're trying to get somebody out of jail or trying to get rid of somebody who is a terrible person. And they always talk about, well, we don't want to appear before this judge. We want to find a judge who's sympathetic. We want to find a judge who will hear our situation and have some mercy. That's what we're learning to be. Because when we learn to err on the side of mercy, then God will give us a little bit more mercy when we fall short. Something that was there all along, I'd just like to read this here in Numbers 35. The Old Testament wasn't just simply a list of do's and don'ts, and if you just followed them, you were okay. There were some concepts in here of discernment, and here's one of them here in Numbers 35. We're going to pick up in verses 10 through 12 of Numbers 35. We all know there's a commandment, thou shalt not kill. Of course, people start to wonder, well, I think it means murder because God said, you know, don't kill. But then the people were supposed to stone that guy and He sent them into war. And so I think there's a difference here. And they begin to argue and discern about that. Let's read here in Numbers 35, verses 10 through 12. Speak to the children of Israel and say to them, when you cross the Jordan into the land of Canaan, then you shall appoint cities to be cities of refuge for you, that the manslayer who kills any person accidentally may flee there. That they shall be cities of refuge for you from the avenger, that the manslayer may not die until he stands before the congregation in judgment. In other words, in the heat of the moment, something bad happens, the family's coming after you. And as you see in so many westerns, when the town comes at the sheriff with the rope and they're going to do some vigilante justice on their own, they don't always wait for the judge. And so God set up this idea of second-degree murder. It's Something we use today. Manslaughter is what we call it. You were careless. You slid off the road and you killed someone. You didn't have murder in your heart. You had no intent for murder, but it happened. Now what happens? Well, if you want to simply go by the law, you eye for an eye, then you got to show up and face your punishment. It's time to die. But God has this concept of mercy and says, you know, let's let them flee to a city where they can maybe get another chance. Maybe clear heads will prevail and that those in the flash of judgment won't come after you and kill you. The concepts of learning how to use judgment tempered with mercy were there. But in that first go with the physical church in the wilderness, they missed it. So the point of Micah is that we are given a formula to how to make those three legs of the stool balance themselves out. Do what we know to be right, but put a premium in our lives on love and mercy and humility so that our judgment may be sound and that we learn to have so much faith in what God is doing in our lives that we actually walk with faith. And if somebody hits a mine, we still have faith. I'm going to walk without the fear. I'm not going to worry about my next step. Each of us every day must make judgments on how we shall live, what should we say, and what should we do. This is discernment wrapped in mercy and exercised in our faith with humility.